Welcome to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age, the show designed to help make middle age your prime time of life by defying the notion that once you reach 40, 50, or even 60 years old, your crowning achievements are all behind you. Regardless of whether you're just approaching 40 or are firmly entrenched in your middle years, it's time to launch your very own personal journey toward a joyful and purpose-filled second half of life. Each week, host Roy Richards, an expert on midlife renewal and author of A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up, will discuss the challenges common to middle age and help guide you to a brighter tomorrow. Now, here's Roy.
Well, hello and welcome to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age. To begin today's program, please ask yourself two questions. Do I look, think, and behave younger or older than my chronological age? That's question number one. Question number two, do I care? Regardless of my age, do I actively strive to remain youthful, energetic, positive, and engaged in the world around me? You know, a couple years back, I attended a high school reunion, and I'm certain many of you have had a similar experience, be it your 25th, 30th, or 40th reunion, whatever. Like me, did you notice that some of your former classmates looks great? They look great, easy to recognize, look 10 years younger than their age, weight under control, healthy skin and complexion. Others not so great. Who is this person? Looks old enough to be my parent, perhaps 30 or more pounds overweight, beer gut, or in contrast, thin but unhealthy, pale and wrinkled, maybe having trouble getting around. And like me, here's another interesting fact I bet you observed. The former classmates who looked young and healthy also spoke and acted young, and they circulated around the room, striking up conversations, smiling and laughing a lot, energizing others with the same energy they felt, and those who looked old and tired probably acted old and tired. They stayed seated or hung out in the corner, avoided contact, seemed almost embarrassed to be seen. When we might as well face it, all of us are growing older. For many, our senior citizen years are not that far away. And hard to believe, but the youngest of you baby boomers are turning 50 this year, and boomers will be turning 65 at a rate of 8,000 to 10,000 a day for the next number of years, and our elderly population will almost double by 2050. Now, be honest with yourself. Do you view aging as a challenge and a privilege, or as an inevitable period of decline? Because here's an interesting challenge. My first guest today suggests that we take on aging as a sport. In an empowered approach any sports fan can relate to, view the common symptoms and conditions of aging as competitors for the opposing team. If you're Michigan, aging is Ohio State. If you're UCLA, aging is Southern California. Now take charge of your life instead of letting age slip away your quality of life. And uh-oh, is that a shark fin that we just spotted on the horizon? No, never fear. It is, in fact, today's guest, Sharky Zartman, and she's a benevolent soul, not here to eat us, but to help us launch and build a joyful, accomplishment-filled second half of life, unleashing the champion inside of you. And Sharky Zartman is a five-time All-American volleyball player at UCLA, a former member of the U.S. Women's National Volleyball Team. She also competed as a pro in beach volleyball. Boy, that was fun watching the Olympics this summer, those two ladies that were so good for the U.S. And she's a member of the California Beach Hall of Fame and an award-winning coach, part-time professor of health and fitness at El Camino Community College, certified yoga instructor, holistic health coach, and host of Sharky's Pep Talk on Healthy Life Radio. I don't know how she has time to do all that, but she's also author of five books, including the one we'll talk about today, Take on Aging as a Sport, The Athletic Approach to Aging. Hello, Sharky, and welcome to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age.
Well, thank you so much. I'm happy to be on the show.
Well, first of all, let me ask you about your fearsome first name. Was it given to you at birth, or did you earn it while making kills on the volleyball court? And what's it like to have such a different name?
Well, I was given Charlene when I was born, but my dad renamed all of us. He gave us all nicknames. And so I got Sharky. That was my nickname. And everybody's called me that. When somebody says Charlene, I don't even turn around. I don't know who they're talking to.
Yeah, I actually love that. I can picture you with a surfboard or something with a name like that. It goes with Southern California for sure.
Yeah.
Well, so precisely, what do you mean by taking on aging as a sport? How can we take an athletic approach to aging when for a lot of us in our late 40s, 50s, and 60s, our bodies seem to be wearing down? We feel very unathletic.
Right. Well, I've seen a lot of people around me as well. I love that example you gave at the reunion about the different kinds of people. It's but it's really prevalent. We see all kinds of people just giving up. They get to a certain age and they just go, oh, well, I guess this is the way it's supposed to be. And instead of doing something about it, because there's so much we can do, they just end up complaining.
Yeah, there's so many
complainers. Whining, and they're no fun to be around. They're grouchy old people.
Well, in your book, you urge us to take charge of our daily lives instead of letting age strip us away the quality of life. And what are some aspects of the aging process that we have power to control? What can we control?
Well, one of the things that we can control for sure is our attitude, because that's where it all starts, is in the brain. It's almost like your cells, your body cells, are listening to your thoughts. And so if you're always thinking negatively, you know, your cells start to malfunction. And I think as a nation, we have really bad attitudes about our aging population. And that's the first place that we have to make the changes.
You seem to have a bad attitude about most everything in politics these days.
I know.
It's pretty pathetic.
I know, And so that's the first place we have to start. And then, you know what's so interesting is I, you know, at the college I see a lot of kids that just say, oh, I don't need to eat healthy. I don't need to exercise. I'm too busy.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you're not going to be able to get away with that for very long.
No, that's true.
And that's one of the things that, you know, that we can control as we age. All of a sudden, you know, we have all these challenges coming at us as we, you know, as we live longer. And a lot of them are because of our bad habits before. And so this is a time to look at our choices, how we got to where we are now. And because in a lot of the symptoms and complaints we have about aging are really, you know, just bad habits catching up to us.
Yeah, that's so true. That it's same with drinking. You know, you can get away with partying all night when you're in college.
Right.
You go through your 20s and 30s, and it just doesn't work.
I know. You do it now, you're in trouble.
Well, when we take on aging as a sport, what should we target as a victory? That's where I have some doubt. You know, certainly we don't expect the same endurance, fitness, and wrinkle-free skin in our 50s that we experienced at age 32. So what do we chalk up as a win when we're playing aging against aging as a sport?
You know, our day-to-day quality of life. I mean, like you said, you know, how do I feel about where I am right now? When you wake up in the morning, what do I want to do? What am I passionate about instead of, oh, gosh, here comes another day?
Yeah,
I mean,
that's,
if you can take each and every day as an opportunity to explore, to learn, to share, to love, you know, all those things, you know. I mean, you know, don't you think that that's a lot better than just getting up and just complaining?
Yeah, it's so true. And the great thing is when you treat aging as a sport, you and you alone can define what a win is. It's not up to anybody else. You and you alone know if you're happy with life or that the people around you are happy and like to be with you and stuff. So that,
exactly. And athletes, you know, at least, you know, the high-level athletes, you talked about the women's volleyball team and the in the Olympics, you know, the doubles team. And I know both of those gals. And I just loved watching them fight for that bronze medal. I mean, you know, Carrie's won 3 golds. And I've never seen her fight for a medal like she and April did for that bronze medal.
Yeah.
And that's what athletes cherish is, you know, the harder it is, the more effort you put into it, and then the more it means.
Yeah.
And, you know, we lose you know, things all the time. Things are going to come up. They're going to knock us down.
Yeah.
And, you know, staying down is just giving up. And so that's why I compare it to being an athlete and aging to being sports, because if we step up and control what we can, you know, we're ahead of the game. And
well, unlike a vanquished volleyball opponent, aging keeps fighting back, and it won't accept the final score. And eventually,
right.
I guess it will win. But how can we remain positive as we fight off aging time and time again? How do you keep that positive attitude?
Well, I think that you just have to realize that you're in you know, it's a privilege to live longer.
Yeah.
I mean, I've lost a lot of people in my life, you know, that are my age and younger. And so I feel like, gosh, there's a reason why I'm still here. And
yeah, I love the way you point out that it's a privilege, especially to be healthy. It's a privilege. And
right.
So many people just expect to be healthy, but it's really something we earn through our good living and the good nutrition and all the other, and the positive attitude, as you point out, and then you should be grateful for it, and also attempt to spread that positive attitude to others is so important.
Right, right. I think a really good goal is to, you know, we all want a long life, but we all want to be productive and happy and, you know, be able to do the things we want to do. Maybe not like we did, obviously, when we were 20 and 30, but still be able to, you know, enjoy the people in our lives, you know, travel, do the things we want to do, and not use age as an excuse for not doing
anything. Yeah, that's part of it. Be realistic about your age. Obviously, you're not going to run a 100-meter dash in the speed you did when you were 23 or something. But, you know, accept what you are, but have realistic, positive expectations and goals for what you can accomplish at various ages. And, you know, it might be fun to have a target of at various ages like 60, 65, and 70 and have something that I remember President George H.W. Bush, I think, jumped out of a or skydived in his 80s or something like that.
Right, right. Well, there's people like that all over the place that are living life like that. And they're just excited about life. You know, people have these bucket lists and, you know, they're crossing them off and they're just engaged. And, you know, for a lot of us, it's like the first time, you know, once we get over 50 that all of a sudden, you know, we don't care about what other people think of us. And,
that's
we're
so
no
good
longer... And, you know, we've already pretty much established our careers and hopefully, you know, I mean, we have that in place. But it's time for us to, what do I really want to do now?
This should be actually the happiest time of life, the late middle age for people, because the kids are pretty much grown now and off on their own.
Right.
And soon to be that. And it's time to really sit back before we get, and I hate to use the word old, but I mean at some point in time, when you get in your late 80s or something, you're not real going to be real active. But this is such an ideal time in early retirement or late working career to really be productive and also to have a great time, because it's just two of you and soon grandkids will come along and that's something else exciting.
Yeah.
But then they go home.
That's right. The great thing about being a grandparent is that you can spoil them and give them back.
Well, let's talk about that. You mentioned there's a mind-body connection, and what is the connection between attitude and aging? Is there any scientific proof to the theory that you can remain young by thinking young? I know you pointed that Baltimore study out in your book.
Right. Well, you know, basically that study was talking about negative attitudes about aging and how these people were more susceptible to have problems with their brains eventually. And I thought that was a huge correlation that we need to kind of go, hey, you know, we need to take a look at this mind-body connection, because, again, we have just so many people that say, well, once you get older, you know, you decline, life sucks, you know, you hurt all the time, and you can't do anything.
Some people just love to talk about that, too.
And they love to complain. I mean, we have, you know, a bunch of people. You say, how are you, to somebody that's like that, and you just get a list of complaints. And, you know, the one thing that I learned to say to people like this, because I deal with a lot of people during the day, is instead of going, well, how are you, I'll say, hey, what's new and good? And it, like, short circuits their brain. They don't even know what to
say. What's this? They're supposed to ask me what's good.
Yeah. Hey, what's new and good? So,
In your book, you emphasize the importance of a favorable diet and nutrition to gain victory over aging. Could you give us a couple of dietary hints? I know it's a huge subject. We've had programs.
Oh, yes.
Before,
I could give you a lot.
What are there certain types of food that we should eat to look and feel young, and certain foods we should cut down on or avoid? I know you don't go into any detail, but just...
You know, our food supply has changed so much in the last few decades. And most of the food that is readily available is all processed foods, which basically have a lot of sugar and a lot of chemicals, preservatives. And, you know, these things cause cell disruption. And, you know, the first thing I always tell my students who are young is they need to start, you know, cutting back on these foods.
They're young and invincible in their own mind.
Yeah, but a lot of them have problems with falling asleep. You know, they don't have any energy. You know, they're kind of negative. And I go, you guys, your cells aren't getting what they need to function. Yeah. I mean, it's like you're malnutrition. Even though you're eating food, this isn't what your body needs.
Yeah.
And so the reverse of that is true, to start crowding out with the foods that we know are healthy. Fruits, vegetables, you know, clean meats, you know, healthy fats, whole grains. I mean, you know, if we just start moving more towards in that direction, it's going to make a huge difference. And they don't have to be big changes. You don't have to be perfect. You just have to start thinking, hey, I need to eat more, you know, good things for my body, and so my body can be healthier, and so I can enjoy my life more.
Yeah.
It's simple.
Well, let's say I'm a listener who's in his or her early 50s, and other than an occasional round of golf with an automated golf cart, my life's pretty sedentary up to now. But is it really necessary to exercise every single day?
You
and,
know,
what types of exercise when
I talk
do you recommend?
Yeah, when I talk about exercise, I'm just talking about moving.
That makes it sound better.
Yes, because a lot of people, take a look at what their jobs are like. They sit all day long, right, at a computer, and, you know, they're stressed out at this computer, and they don't get up and move.
Yeah.
And just 30 minutes, no matter what you do, and I say, you know, they go, well, what should I do? And I go, whatever you will do.
Because
you tell them to do something. I don't want to do that, you know. And so, you know, I mean, what do you like to do? I mean, your body is meant to move. I had this one student who didn't like anything, but she liked to dance. And so I said, okay, dance for 30 minutes a day.
Yeah,
you
that's
know,
a great
on a
exercise.
DVD, whatever. It made a huge difference.
Yeah.
It totally changed her attitude. It changed her body, you know, just. So it doesn't take much. Obviously, you can do more than that if you want.
That's great.
But I would say at least 30 minutes a day. You know, make it as important as brushing your teeth. You wouldn't go without a day of brushing your teeth.
Well, that's
you know?
Pretty good exercise. Moving that arm up and down.
No, not just. I'm not talking about using that as exercise.
That would be more than some people get, I guess. But
yeah, I know. I know.
Well, in your book, a stated goal is to help empower readers to awaken their inner athlete, as you put it, in order to step up to the challenges of aging. But not all of us are athletes now, nor were we athletes in our youth. Do sedentary individuals who never competed in sports have an inner athlete we can turn to? And if yes, how do we awaken this capacity we've never previously called upon?
Okay, well, I have a sister-in-law who has never played sports, but she is a huge basketball fan.
Oh,
and when she watches our home team, she, yells and screams and, you know, cheers and throws things. I mean, she is deeply invested into this team. Yeah. And she knows everything about what they should be doing and how stupid the coach is and all that, you know. So I think a lot of people can identify with sports even if they never played them.
That's a good point.
Yeah, we have that part of us that's a competitor inside, the part that says, I don't know the meaning of the word can't. We just need to focus it in a direction. And so I'm saying activate that inner athlete so that you can enjoy the rest of your life.
Yeah, and others, you know, have excelled in maybe drama, or they excel playing a musical instrument or whatever, so that anything that you really excel in, you can use that same type of principle in fighting off aging.
Right.
Well, let's talk a bit about your latest book, Take on Aging as a Sport, The Athletic Approach to Aging. How old is the targeted reader? Is your book written mostly for baby boomers in their 50s and 60s, or will younger middle-aged readers like also benefit?
I think so. I think the baby boomers, you know, was written with them in mind.
Yeah.
Although my daughter one day said, "Mom, I'm so depressed." And I go, "Why?" And she goes, "Because I'm 35.
Yeah.
I went, "Oh, for Pete's sake, are you kidding me?" You know, so, I mean, these people in their 30s, they're scared of getting old because of what they see. So I think, you know, we're all gonna age. And if we do, that's great. You know, because we have more time here to enjoy, you know, our life.
The alternative is not that great.
So step up and get over yourself. Stop, you know, and stop lying about your age. I hate it when people lie about their age.
That's so
silly. Be proud.
Yeah. Well, is there a single roadmap to health that applies to everyone, or are your readers guided to create their own personal roadmap? And how do we do that?
Well, I do have, you know, just some general, I have a general game plan at the back of the book that anybody can take and utilize the way that they want. And, you know, it's, you know, so it obviously can be fine-tuned because we are not all alike. We're all, I love the concept of bio-individuality.
Yeah.
You know, I use that all the time with my students for how they eat, how they exercise. We're all different, and so we have different things that work for us. What I don't like is when something is wrong and the person immediately just goes to the doctor and the doctor gives them medications, and obviously sometimes that's needed, but we do that too often. And especially as we age, we want people to take care of us and make things better, make us feel better. Well, you know what? It's time for us to step up and take responsibility for our lives.
Our
doctors should be a part of our team.
That's so true. It's a team, and you're actually the principal player because you have the most skin in the game.
That's
more
right.
than your doctor.
That's right. It needs to be a part of your team. Sometimes people need to fire their doctors. Sometimes they need to find somebody else who's more in line with what they want. And so,
Well, where's the best place for listeners to go to preview and purchase your book? I assume it's on Amazon.
Yes, it is on Amazon. It's also Barnes & Noble. And, you know, if it's not in the store, you can always ask and they'll order it. And, so it's getting pretty good reviews up on Amazon. I think it's kind of touching a nerve. I've had some people go, "Gosh, you know, now I'm not depressed anymore about being 53. I'm going, oh, my gosh, you know. And I had this one woman who kind of gave me that attitude about, a sport, you know, that's kind of demeaning.
Yeah.
But by the end of the interview, because she interviewed me, she goes, "I want to be on the team, you know. I want to be first string." And I go, "Well, you know, that's good, because when we first started talking, you were on the bench."
Well, give us your website where we can learn more. And also, on your website, you have a connection to your program, Sharky's Pep Talk, which...
So my website is just sharkyzartman.com, SharkyZartman, all one word, .com. And I also have a website for the book, agingasasport.com.
Okay, well, that's two places to go then. Well, in conclusion, by now most of us at middle age know there's a strong connection between mind and body, and a positive, vibrant, can-do attitude goes along with a fit, healthy, and youthful appearance at any age. And unfortunately, the reverse also is true. As Sharkey puts it, if you think you're old, you will start to act like it, and the body will follow. And for heaven's sake, don't think like you're old. Regardless of chronological age, your best days are not all behind you. And as Sharkey Zartman urges, think of aging as a game and of you as a star athlete who has the ability to defeat it. And here's the best part. You get to set your goals and define victory. And if you consider yourself energetic, grateful, and at peace with the world, you win. If you're having a good time simply being alive, and you're an inspiration to at least one other person, you win. And above all else, never concede defeat. As Sharkey puts it, if you get knocked down by one of age's bombs, you just have to brush it off, get back up, and keep moving forward. And that's certainly better than the alternative, ending up as a grumpy old person no one wants to be around. And that downcast, grumpy attitude isn't hard only on those around you. You also suffer. It simply isn't any fun to outlive your happiness, is it? And if your present age or concern over soon growing old is getting you down, I highly recommend you preview Sharkey Zartman's book, Taking on Aging as a Sport, and I also recommend her website, SharkeyZartman.com. Contrary to any remaining doubts, you do not have to turn into your grandmother or your grandfather. It's your choice. And thank you, Sharkey, for your most inspirational comments.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show. I had a great time.
And all of you out there, forget growing old and go out and live today like you're still youthful and you've still got it. You're still the man or the lady. And thanks for joining us, Middle Age on Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age. During the remainder of today's program, we're going to talk about a subject far removed from our usual discussion of midlife renewal. You know, in the U.S. this fall, we've just suffered through a long, divisive, and highly contentious national election campaign. And now that the election season is at its conclusion, thank the Lord, perhaps it's time we take time out to reflect on just how great we have it here in North America and the freedoms we all must strive to protect. The freedom to differ and to openly express our opinions, the right as individuals to practice the religion and culture of our own choosing, and throughout our history, the peaceful transition of power through the without violence at the ballot box. But it's also important to remember that not so long ago, in escalating violence, Adolf Hitler's Nazi Germany first isolated, then enslaved, and ultimately killed 6 million European Jews, including 1.5 million innocent children. And because the Holocaust occurred in a faraway land, well before most of us were born, it may be difficult to relate to just how horrible it was. But my next guest, Alexandra Weinbaum, is here to remind us and to give us a glimpse into what life was like in the Jewish ghettos of Lodz and Warsaw, Poland, and of the remarkable courage of persecuted Eastern European Jews before, during, and after World War II. You know, in February 1996, shortly after her mother died, Alexandra's son discovered a small carton containing 169 letters and postcards, many written from the ghetto by her maternal grandmother and other family members. Filled with love, hope, longing, and desperation, they document the bravery and tragedy suffered by persecuted Jews, and only two of the letter writers would survive the war. And Alexandra Weinbaum has written a book about it titled Careful Old Letters, A Jewish Family's Story, Lodz, Warsaw, Paris. And Alexandra Weinbaum grew up in Philadelphia, received her B.A. from Smith College and a Ph.D. in Russian history from Columbia. She dedicated 20 years of her career to improving educational opportunities for low-income and underserved kindergarten through 12th grade students. She's lead author of the professional book for teachers, Teaching as Inquiry, and now she's returned to her love of history with her 2015 book, Careful Old Letters. And hello, Alexandra. It's indeed an honor to have you with us here today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure as well.
Well, to begin, tell us how you felt when that box of letters and postcards was discovered. Were the revelations contained in the correspondence a complete shock to you, or how much of that did you know beforehand?
I knew a little bit from my childhood, but like most survivors, and my parents were survivors in the sense that they came in the middle of 1938, which was about the last minute you could possibly come, and pretty much they lost everyone. There were only two survivors after the war, and they had left everybody behind. And I didn't know much as a very young child, of course, but when I was 10 or 11, my parents showed me a postcard that was written from my maternal grandmother, my mother's mother, and it had a swastika on it, and they read it to me. Hello?
Hello?
Are you still there?
Yes, I'm there. I don't know what
happened. So, and they read it to me, and it was essentially asking for food, those basic food items.
Yeah.
And and they explained a little bit of what happened, but not in great detail, as was usual among parents. They tried to move on, and it was very painful and difficult to talk about it. But I knew something, of course.
Yeah, they try to protect their children from finding out the horrors of the world, but maybe it's better to learn what's going on. I don't know. But well, what inspired you to write a book to share these deeply personal family communications with the world? What inspired you to do that?
Well, I found the box when I was cleaning out an old storage closet, and I was about to throw it away, and I was with my son, and he said, wait a minute, Mom, look, and I looked at the cover of the box, and it said, careful old letters, very big scrawl that my father had, and I opened it up, and of course, I saw all of the postcards with swastikas on them, and many, many other letters. There were also letters from before the war, and my parents came to the United States.
Oh, I...
And then afterwards from the two survivors.
And well, how did you come up with the title for your book, Careful Old Letters? I know that was on the box, but what does the careful mean?
I think that my father consciously was just saying, keep this box, perhaps unconsciously saying, but beware, it's going to make you very sad when you...
Well, I guess the letter writers also had to be very careful because the Nazis were... didn't they read most of the correspondence that came and went from the Jewish people in the ghettos, and they were nosing into your business? So I guess you had to be somewhat careful of what you said in the letters.
Absolutely. And she also... my grandmother was a quite educated woman. She also wrote in German. So, and
wow,
they were postcards. So 39 of the 169 letters and postcards were written from the Lodz ghetto, and they were in German because she knew she could get it through the censors that way.
Well, tell us a bit about this remarkable lady, her life in the ghetto, and her ultimate fate.
Well, so she writes right to my parents right after they left for the United States, and shortly after that, my grandfather died, and she's in great sorrow and pain, and she says, I can't possibly come to you, I'm too sad, it's too terrible, and then all of a sudden, she realizes that things are hopeless around her, and she decides she's going to try to come to the United States, and actually, on the very day that the war began, on the very day that the Germans invaded Poland, my grandmother was in an office in Lodz trying to get information about how to emigrate to the United States.
Oh, wow. What bad timing.
Of course, she never was able to do it.
Well, and what year were your grandmother and grandfather evicted from their home and forced into the Lodz ghetto? And what was that experience like? That just seems so horrible to me. Were they given any advance warning? And what personal wealth and family possessions were they permitted to take with them into the ghetto? Were their bank accounts and financial assets confiscated? That just sounds so horrible to me when somebody invades your privacy like that.
Well, the very beginning of the war was horrific, and people were being slaughtered on the street, and especially people who had any role in the government or were quite well known. There were actually horrible things that went on.
Wow.
But in May 1940, all of the Jews who were left in Poland, and many of them fled to Warsaw because they thought it was safer there, which it really wasn't, they were herded essentially into the poorest part of Lutz, Bawuti it's called. It's still very poor. Yeah. And so there were 160,000 Jews who were herded into a very small area.
Oh, wow.
I have photos of some of the old buildings in that area that I saw actually fairly recently in 2012 when I visited Poland. Old wooden buildings, and they were crammed into essentially probably one room. It was, and there were a number of people from the family all crammed in together.
I think in your book you said like your grandmother was only permitted to take one suitcase with her into the ghetto.
Correct, one suitcase, and she basically had nothing, and they weren't allowed to have money. She writes in the beginning a little bit about trying to access money through, believe it or not, a German bank where she had some money invested, but of course she couldn't have it. And she was older at the time; she was in her 50s, and so she wasn't employed. Her sister, however, was employed. She helped in. She led a kitchen in the ghetto. But essentially, they had nothing.
Well, tell us about the remarkable ingenuity that helped Jews cope with the harsh conditions of the ghettos. How did families in the ghetto obtain enough food to eat and clothing and medical care when needed, and how did they pay for it when they didn't have any money? Didn't a large number of Jews must have died of malnutrition, I would presume?
That was the greatest killer. Malnutrition, ultimately. That was the greatest killer, with complications afterwards, typhus and so forth. And my grandmother survived, actually, until September 28, 1942. I have her death certificate. So the ghettos, the Germans were very clever about this, the Nazis, I should say, and they created ghettos where the Jews were essentially the administration and in control. So whatever food was distributed, how they were able to access it, of course, it was very difficult. Starvation was the major problem and cause of death, but it was a Jewish administration which controlled it. And, of course, people tried to have employment so that they would have – there was an internal currency. It wasn't a real currency that was, passed around within the ghetto. But for my grandmother, who didn't have a so-called profession, there was very little she could do. And my grandfather had already died, so she felt very dependent upon other relatives. And she writes about that she feels embarrassed, that she has to depend on the kindness of others.
Well, what impressed me the most about your grandmother's letters and postcards, she seemed to downplay her own deprivations, so much hunger and ill health, and even in the toughest times, she demonstrated so much love and concern for her children, your parents, and other relatives in America. That's
exactly right. I think that is the amazing thing, that she's trying to get them to understand their circumstances. She can't be too, direct about it because it's dangerous. It won't pass the censors. And at the same time, she's so concerned about them. And, of course, they were pioneers in their own way. I mean, it was difficult for my parents when they got there, but nothing compared to her difficulties. And probably until somewhat in the middle of the war, they couldn't really, really understand what was happening.
No, it's some people in the West never really understood just how awful it was, I guess. But as bad as conditions were for the Jews in the ghettos of Lodz and Warsaw, what actions did the Germans begin taking in 1942 that made the situation infinitely worse? I guess that was the final solution or something.
Correct, and that was the final solution, and she was just, I don't have the dates in front of me, but that was when the big deportations began.
Yeah, and the disgusting thing was they deported the young children and the old to, I think, Treblinka, 50 miles from Warsaw, and sent them immediately to the gas chambers. It's just so horrible.
And the people from Lodz didn't go. They went to Chełmno, actually.
Oh.
And then at the very end to Auschwitz. But to Chełmno was the first place where actually they experimented with the gassing of people.
Oh, isn't that great? Well, even after World War II ended in 1945, conditions remained deplorable for many of the Holocaust survivors. Tell us the sad story of your father's first cousin, Dosia, and how she survived a concentration camp but suffered through tragic post-war trauma right up until her untimely death years later. That's a very sad story as well, and you have some of her letters in there, I guess.
Yes, I did. And she was my father's first cousin. And immediately after the war, she goes back to Lodz. And she writes to my parents that it isn't the same place anymore, and she's desperate to get out. She had some work afterwards. She was a very bright woman. So, of course, my parents tried to get her out. But it took 2 years. And there was hope in that first letter that she writes. It's a very moving letter. And she just says, I can't live here anymore. But it took 2 years, and I think that took a tremendous toll of her. I knew her. I was only 5 years old when she came to live with us in 1947. And she learned English well. She had married somebody while she was there, and he joined her. It wasn't a very happy marriage. And she had a child here, and this child, who was a wonderfully bright young man, ultimately was killed in a car accident.
Yeah, that was so sad.
Just totally, totally tragic. But I did know her at that moment, and I remember her lying on our couch, and she had a Band-Aid over her numbers from the ghetto that she Auschwitz. She was actually in Auschwitz.
Yeah. Well, who are you hoping will read your book, and what do you want readers to take away upon reading it?
I think that people, I think there's, first of all, and there's a movement underfoot to deny the Holocaust that's going on now, and it's actually becoming stronger, particularly in some Eastern European countries.
That's
so
incredible.
It's very useful to have authentic letters that tell exactly what it was like. You can't deny it if you read those letters. They're not invented, and the originals can be obtained. So I think that's an important part of it. I also think that it's a story about my parents in part, and of immigrants, and how difficult it was, and the pain that they had to live with for a long time of losing everyone. I think there was probably a lot of guilt in a certain way, maybe not expressed, but certainly was there, and I think that's important to understand that. And I think the kind of heroism that people actually exhibited, which comes out in the letters.
Yeah, it's remarkable the number of ordinary people that are pushed to their extreme limits, and they still maintain the sense of love and connectiveness, and they want to know how their relatives are doing in America and other places. It's truly remarkable to read that.
Yes, that's I think, and I think because I think in order to survive, people had to have hope. They had to believe that they were going to be either reunited, and this horrible war would end. You see that in my grandmother's letters.
Well, where's the best place to go to preview and purchase your book, Careful Old Letters?
Well, it was published by Epigraph Publishers, but you can get it on either Amazon or Barnes & Noble. I would say Amazon is the easier place. And also can get it from the publisher, Epigraph.
But, that's great.
You know, Amazon is easy to access, and it's right there. There are very few books with the same name.
It was easy for me to find.
Exactly.
Well, in conclusion, I read Alexander Weinbaum's book over last weekend, and I can't say it was an enjoyable experience, but it certainly inspired me and offers all of us a strong and courageous message. And as North Americans or other citizens of the free world, we need to be eternally grateful for the freedom to choose and the ability to live out our lives in relative comfort. But it also offers a warning, because Alexander's book is not simply a history lesson from 75 years ago, because there are people in Syria and Iraq and other places in Africa and other places in the world that are probably living through the same nightmare today, as their homes and villages are destroyed, and they must commit to certain religious or cultural beliefs just to survive, and we mustn't think that it can't happen here because recent verbal attacks on peaceful practitioners of the Muslim religion are not all that dissimilar to what peace-loving Jews suffered in Germany and Eastern Europe in the late 1930s, and obviously we need to depend upon our elected leaders to protect us from terrorists who would destroy our way of life. But on the other hand, we as a country must never persecute nor turn our backs on a large group of individuals based solely upon their race, ethnic background, or religion. And thank you, Alexander Weinbaum, for the poignant message that you're sending through that wonderful book of yours, Careful Old Letters, A Jewish Family Story.
Thank you. I loved what you just said.
And best of success in the continued sale of your book. And thanks to you listeners for joining us. Please tune in again next week when we'll return to our more conventional message of middle age renewal. Goodbye for now.
You've been listening to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age, hosted by Roy Richards, an expert on midlife renewal and author of both A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up, and Wake Up, Captain and Crew, Restart Your Engines. You can learn more about Roy and his Middle Age Renewal Training System by visiting his website, middleagerenewal.com.